Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Oh, the places you will go. Vietnam, Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, South Africa, Burma. These are just some of the places in the world that have seen the profound violation of human rights and lack of social justice. Beyond that, what they all have in common are the efforts of one woman, Nobel Peace Prize winner Jody Williams, to seek justice, to fight for those being persecuted, and to never fear speaking truth to power. Today, this Nobel Peace Prize winner for her campaign to ban landmines has joined forces with six other women Nobel Prize winners to form the Nobel Women's Initiative, and still continues to bring her considerable power and skills to bear to fight against war, personal violence, and injustice. Today she shares a bit of how all of this came to be in her new memoir, My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. It is my pleasure to welcome Jody Williams to the program. Jody, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And don't you love the clever title of my book?
Yes, indeed.
Hard to forget.
It's not a title that anybody else could get.
That is true. Maybe the second half, but definitely not the first. You make me sound marvelous. I just want to point out that it was because of tens of thousands of people around the world that we achieved the Mind Ban Treaty. My mother loves it when people introduce me as, you know, an example of a human who can change the world. I helped.
I want to talk about that first, because as we look at this cynical time in which we live today, even with all the technology that's available to us and all the ability to organize that really wasn't there when you were engaged in this effort, it is hard to imagine that one person can make a difference. But indeed you did. As you say, there were thousands of other people that engaged in the effort with you, but it took somebody to organize it, to start it, to get it off the ground.
That's true. I have a talent for, you know, bringing organizations together to work in coalition, and that was my contribution. I mean, the campaign is still going strong, which is why the treaty is so strong and almost universally obeyed by the 161 countries that are part of it. But we had, you know, deminers who could talk about that aspect. We had humanitarian groups that helped give new prosthetic limbs to mine victims and train them to make them themselves so they would also be employed. Human Rights Watch that, you know, could talk about the legal aspects of banning the weapon. There were so many talents in that campaign, and it was all of us together that just made us unstoppable.
And yet it wasn't an issue that the world immediately took notice of. It took time to get people to pay attention.
It's true, but, you know, when I think in terms of other global treaties, for example, you know, we formally launched the landmine campaign in, October of 92, and by the end of September of 97, we had a mine ban treaty. So it was 5 years, you know, from nobody thinking about landmines to banning them. It was really remarkable.
A treaty still not signed by the United States.
No, but followed to the letter by the U.S., which is one of the most, you know, confusing things if you think about it. We haven't used landmines since when? The first Gulf War in 91. We haven't exported since 92. We haven't produced since the mid-90s. We've destroyed millions in our stockpiles, and we give more money than any other country in the world to mine clearance and victim assistance. So we're following, you know, every obligation, and yet we haven't signed.
Why do you think that is?
I honestly think the major issue is that the U.S. military, you know, Department of Defense does not like to have ordinary people like you and me have any say in the weapons they choose to use or the weapons they choose to develop. They think that it is their purview, and we really have no business sticking our nose in areas of, you know, where we are not so-called experts. I profoundly disagree. Supposedly, you know, those weapons are being used to defend U.S. citizens, and they're being used in my name. I don't want them using indiscriminate weapons that are going to kill more civilians than cause benefit for the military using them.
Does it trouble you still that the U.S. hasn't signed?
It would trouble me more if they hadn't signed and they were using landmines. The fact that they're obeying the treaty, you know, I'd rather have their name on the paper, but they're obeying it. So I can't be as hysterical as I might be.
We talked about, and you've talked about, all the people that were involved in this effort. What role did Princess Diana actually play in the effort, and how important was it?
Well, it was important in that she brought the issue to millions around the world. And that's certainly very important. On the other hand, by the time she made the first of her two trips to landmine-infected countries, the world was already negotiating the mine ban treaty. So it's hard to say. We would have had the treaty without her having gone to Angola, which was her first trip, or to Bosnia. But she certainly made people aware, and perhaps that has had an impact on governments that might otherwise not have joined the treaty.
One of the things you talk about is that in addition to the effort to get this treaty, that for a long time you've fought hard for other causes around the world, both before and after, and that it comes out of a righteous indignation with social injustice in the world. Talk a little bit about the evolution of that philosophy for you. How did this come to be?
Many aspects of it. My father had extreme indignation at injustice of the wealthy toward the poor. He grew up poor. I found out after he died, he was too embarrassed to talk about it when he was still alive, that he did not live in a house with indoor plumbing, an indoor bathroom, running water, or electricity until he was 17 years old. And it was during the Depression, and he was treated badly by the people in his tiny, tiny town who were charged with administering the government money that helped people during the Depression. So he had quite a fierce feeling toward people who were willing to abuse people who did not have money or power. So that's somewhere in there. And my brother, my oldest brother, Stephen, was born deaf and was especially taunted by boys in the neighborhood. And I started defending him like the other members of my family, and it enraged me that people would make fun of him because of the sounds he made when he couldn't hear the sounds he was making and he couldn't talk. And if he'd had his choice, he would have been able to hear and speak. So yes, it made me incredibly angry.
It does seem that it was really, as you write about it, the combination of both those two things, your father's sense of social injustice combined with the tremendous empathy that evolved for you as a result of taking care and watching your brother Stephen.
I also, thought a lot as I, kept getting older about sort of the lemmingish nature of human beings, willing to follow the strong guy and not speak out when they knew injustice was being carried out. And I guess it was partly my brother, and then having the courage to defend another young boy during grade school when I was trembling on the inside and the outside, but felt I would be less of a human being if I didn't defend him in the face of a bully. And then I found that every time you do what you believe to be right, it becomes easier. And now I can't imagine not.
As much as you've traveled the world, you spent the first 25 years of your life never leaving Vermont. Talk a little about that.
never thought I would. It's a marvelous place. I still, my family's there. I'm the only one who ever left. I feel Vermont in my blood, in my bones, as I wrote in the book. I have a house there. I go as often as I can. And yet somehow I felt like I had to go out into the world and see how I could contribute to making the United States be everything it says it is, and which it still isn't.
As you look back at the efforts that you've been engaged in stopping the war in Vietnam, the efforts against apartheid, efforts in Guatemala, talk about how the nature of protest, the nature of what people have done to fight these injustices, how that's changed over the years.
Well, I think about my first protest, which was at the University of Vermont during the war in Vietnam. And I think about, that time, which was so charged, because it wasn't just Vietnam. It was the civil rights movement. It was the reemergence of, the feminist movement. There was so much social upheaval and turmoil going on then that you almost couldn't avoid protesting. Today, it's different. We have social media, Twitter, Facebook, all of that. And I think sometimes people get confused and think that using social media alone as activism? I don't believe that. I think it's a tool of activism. But activism to me is really based on the word act. And we really bring about change when people come together in a coordinated strategy to bring about change. I also think part of the issue today is that the media does not cover protests the way it used to. I think that, you know, I mean, look at the Occupy movement across the U.S. and the world, for that matter. How much did we really ever see that was positive about what people were trying to do? How much did we ever see about, you know, how often protests were going on, the violent reaction to the protests by police and security forces? I think it's also hard for people, if they don't know that other people around the world are protesting the same thing, they feel afraid. They think if they speak out, something might happen to them. And I don't certainly think that was the case during the Vietnam War.
Do you think that the cynicism of our age today has done a lot to blunt kind of righteous anger that people might have?
I don't think it's cynicism. Maybe for us old people. But I don't see that in young people. What I mostly see, and I speak a fair amount at universities, and I also am part of an organization called Peace Jam, which is Jamming for Peace, which is 11 Nobel laureates that work with young people, trying to help them understand that there are many ways to contribute to peace. These kids want to make change in the world. They want to do something that matters. I think that there is so much, you know, overwhelming information, if we can call what we get on Facebook, Twitter, even some of the regular media information, that they feel like they can't, you know, do anything. And if you can't make it all better almost overnight, what is the point of trying? I think for older activists like myself, part of my job as I see it is to help young people understand that if every single person who really wanted to see a better world for us all even volunteered a few hours a month on whatever issue they care about, it doesn't have to be anything I care about, if we all volunteered a bit, imagine the world we would live in. I started as a volunteer. That's how I started as an activist, and I was a volunteer for quite a while before I decided, I guess it was my career, and here I am decades later still pounding away at it.
And you touch on something very important in that, that it does take time. The landmine mm-hmm. campaign, even 5-6 years that took, mm-hmm. that today we look for instant solutions. We want an app for that, whatever the problem may be.
Exactly. But I think the most important thing is to do the work we believe in because we believe in it, not because we will necessarily see change in our lifetime, even though we want to. Not because we'll be recognized or not for what we do. I mean, another thing Dad taught us, you know, my siblings and myself, was to do the right thing even when nobody else is looking. And I think that's really important. You do it because it's the right thing to do.
Talk about the Nobel Women's Initiative that you're currently engaged in.
Mm-hmm. It was actually birthed, if you will, by a conversation between Shirin Ebadi and myself. Shirin, of course, being the first Muslim woman to receive the Peace Prize, and that was in 2003. She's from Iran. We were in Nairobi, Kenya in 2004, right after Wangari had been announced as the prize winner. And Shirin and I were talking about the number of women alive then who had received the Peace Prize, which at that point, I think we were 7. And at that point, there were only 12 in the entire 3-year history of the Peace Prize who'd received the prize. Just imagine that. And 7 of us are alive. So it shows the incredible sexism of the Nobel committees over time. But as we were talking, she said, look, there's a critical mass. Why don't we come together and try to find a way to use our influence and access to shine the spotlight on women's organizations around the world working for peace with justice and equality. And it was totally exciting to me. It really kind of for the first time made me really excited about the Peace Prize personally, because I saw through the initiative that it was going to be a way for me and us to share the Peace Prize. And I have loved every minute that we have been able to move forward with the Nobel Women's Initiative. We've been able to help so many organizations in the world simply by standing with them. I mean, and that's the whole point. It's not that we want to speak on their behalf. It's that we want to stand with them so that they get attention that they otherwise would not get and can advance the work they're doing. And it has just been phenomenal.
As you watched the protests going on during the Arab Spring, talk a little bit about what you saw in that.
Well, I think like everybody, I was captivated by the seemingly out of nowhere burst of, you know, desire for change. And I think it's also obvious that nothing ever bursts out of nothing, that there had been decades and generations of frustration throughout the region, and people finally communicated and took action. Somewhat recently, I was at a conference somewhere, and I've been at so many places I cannot remember, to be honest, and there was somebody from Egypt talking about their frustration, however, at the perception that the uprisings in Tahrir Square in the beginning were sort of a cellular phone revolution. And they were frustrated by that because they clearly recognized that the cell phone was a tool. It was a way to communicate easily with people, you know, in Cairo and other places to come to X place at X time and join in the demonstration. But if people had not turned out, it wouldn't have mattered. And I think that's something we have to keep in mind. And another thing is that those, you know, uprisings are still revolution in motion, if you will. I mean, there's a lot of backlash, confusion, because people turned out in the streets wanting change did not necessarily mean they had a common vision of what that change might be. And I've been particularly disturbed, as have other women, both in the Nobel Women's Initiative and outside of it, by the backlash against women. It's been quite horrifying.
When you look at other protest movements, is that, though, a sort of first step in the process that people have to get angry even before they're really clear about what they want to see in terms of the nature of change?
Not always. I think sometimes people just rise up out of anger and confusion. I think other times people strategically plan what they want to do and they move forward and do it. And I'm thinking of the, you know, small comparison of the landmine movement. We knew what we were going for from day one, which is certainly very different, however, from a total, you know, socioeconomic revolution throughout the Middle East. You know, the various issues are huge. Obviously, the Middle East uprisings, landmines is landmines. We were clear.
Do we need to see, would you like to see, a kind of rebirth of activism in this country?
I'd like to see a rebirth of democracy in this country. And for that to happen, I think there'll have to be a rebirth of activism. I really do find the amount of money that goes into, you know, campaigns for public office to be, I mean, it's overt corruption. We like to talk about corrupt electoral processes in other parts of the world. Look at this country. And the, you know, the ruling by the Supreme Court letting corporations give however much money they want. Sorry, the Constitution of the United States is we the people, not we the corporations. And I think it's only going to get worse if people don't become active in understanding what being an active citizen is, understanding civics, understanding, you know, the various elements of government and the supposed balance of power, and reclaim democracy. We need activism for that and, you know, to face all the other challenges we face in today's world.
And as you go around the country talking to college students, younger people, what are you hearing in that regard?
I think they're thinking about many, many things. I don't know how many specifically are disturbed about democracy. I think when I start talking about it, then I begin to hear some conversation. I think what I hear more is real concern about global warming and the climate, LGBT issues, things like that. Maybe they still suffer the illusion that they're living in a democracy, like we believed, you know, with the founding fathers. And when I was growing up in teeny tiny Pulteney, Vermont with 1,200 people. I think these kids are a little confused about what democracy means today.
But they do have seemingly a greater global perspective than previous generations in some respects.
Well, they have certainly an access to more information about global issues. I'm not sure if that makes them more sophisticated or more able to be active in ways that can help us all on the planet. I think that's a process, and I think you need role models sometimes for that.
What are the other things today, finally, that still make you angry? What are the other causes that you want to still devote yourself to?
Well, there are two primary campaigns that I'm involved with, and one is the International Campaign to Stop Rape and Gender Violence in Conflict, which was spearheaded by the Nobel Women's Initiative last May. And we now have over 700 non-governmental organizations that are part of that effort, trying to work with governments that share the same goals and the UN, et cetera, to stop this pandemic. And the other is called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, and we will be launching it in April in London. And when I say killer robots, I'm not talking about drones, because drones have human beings involved who pull the trigger. Killer robots are or will be fully autonomous machines that on their own can kill human beings. And I find that appalling and morally and ethically offensive that my country is taking the lead in trying to develop those weapons.
Jody Williams, her memoir is My Name is Jody Williams, A Vermont Girl's Winding Path to the Nobel Peace Prize. Jody, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been fun talking to you.
Thank you.